You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 70. The size of the budget doesn't make that much of a difference because the kind of issues I have on low budget film, I have on big budget films as well, but they're just much bigger. James Wan.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we have some cheapskate movie makers. That's right. Today's guests are Steve Hutchinson and PJ Woodside, who wrote the book Cheapskate Movie Makers, How We Made 10 Horror Movies in 9 Years with Nearly Zero Budget. Now, I wanted to have PJ and Steve on the show because they are disciples of the Filmtrepreneur method before I wrote the book. They had been creating multiple revenue streams to help them sell their movies, to help generate revenue from their films in many, many ways, and they've been doing it for well over a decade now. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with PJ Woodside and Steve Hutchins. I'd like to welcome to the show Steve Hutchins and PJ Woodside. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. It's good to see you.
Doing good.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, guys. I am a fan of how you have been able to survive in this insane independent filmmaking space for years. A mutual friend of ours connected us, Linda from Indie Rights. She suggested that I reach out to you guys to be on the show because you guys were doing some really cool stuff on how you've been able to basically sustain yourselves for a better part of a decade, if I'm not mistaken. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. We've been doing this since about 2007. So sustain, I don't know if that's quite the right word, but at least it's amused us for all this time anyway.
You have kept going. In other words, you keep doing it. So you're doing something right at this point. So how did you guys get started in the business?
Well, when we started, we were involved in theater. Mm-hmm. And Steve and I had met doing some plays. We know a lot of theater folks around here. He's the one who really got started with the movie making, had an idea to make a movie. It was just starting to be that time when you could do such a thing on your own. You know, you could get an editing program and a pretty, you know, decent camera with not too much outlay of money and film something and cut it together and put it up online. And so he and some friends of his, and I'm going to let you jump in here and tell that story here. Steve, but they kind of did the first pilot movie and got everything started just by trial and error.
Yeah, we had been I did a play with a couple of guys and we got to be friends. And started kicking around the idea of making a movie. And I had always been a writer, like PJ. We're both writers, really. And I took one of my one of them had a little bit of filmmaking experience. And by a little, I mean like they've shot a camera. They used a camera before. So I took an old book that I wrote when I was a kid and turned it into a screenplay. And we just decided to do it, not really knowing what the hell we were doing, but we just did it. And it took about 6 months, and we were able to get some pretty cool locations, people just letting us use locations. And we just shot a really, really bad movie, but we did it. We were able to complete it. It's like it was like over 100 minutes. It really, in reality, if we edited that thing today, it would probably be 60 minutes. Well, this is like over 100 minutes. It's got like a good 40 minutes of fat. But, you know, we did it. We shot the movie. We edited it. We premiered it. And we learned a ton just doing it. It was the hands-on experience where we really learned. And at the end of that, those two guys were burned out. They were done. And I was just getting warmed up. That's when I knew, you know, this was something I really had a fire for. I'm just warmed up now. Let's go. And they're like, no, I think we're done. So I kind of created my own production company, Big Biting Pig Productions. And PJ had a little editing experience. So she helped. She really did the majority of the editing on that movie. So we worked together a lot in the post-production of that movie. The movie's called The Third Floor. We don't talk about that. It's not one of our Big Biting Pig library. It's not in one of the Big Biting Pig movies, really. Mm-hmm. We did that under another production company name. But PJ did the editing, the majority of it. I did too. And we just kind of learned together. And then we teamed up. When I said, I'm going on my own, I got PJ with me. And we've been together ever since. And we did... We were able to release 10 movies with absolutely no budget in 9 years.
That's
yeah. What he didn't tell you about that first movie too was a standard definition and no idea what the editing was going to be. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like, oh, now we've got all this footage. Now what do we do? So I like to kind of point out that we didn't follow another model. We sort of just try things to see what we could do. And then we would do it the simplest and cheapest way we could and kept making progress on our skills and, production values and getting more people involved in more places and just, you know, trial, a lot of trial and error and a lot of just throwing things at the wall to see what sticks, you know?
It's like Kubrick says, the best film school is actually making a movie. And I think that's what you guys did. And as someone who's went to film school, I went to film school, a technical school, and I basically learned how to wrap cable and make a cup of coffee. That was the extent of my education in many ways. I didn't really start learning until I got into the field and started actually doing stuff. So I think that's one of the best pieces of advice you could give a filmmaker, without question. Now, you talk about zero budgets. Now, I know that a lot of people throw that number around really quick. Oh, it's zero budgets. Obviously, it's not zero budget because you need to have to spend some sort of money. But can you define what zero budget is for you?
When I say zero budget, I mean we don't have money budgeted before we make the movie. We don't have like a pile of cash that we've put together and say, this is all going towards the movie. Mm-hmm. So there really is no budget. But yes, of course, we do spend some money on it. But everything we spend is out of pocket as we go. We don't know how much we're going to spend, but we try to keep it as little as possible. And once we got the equipment, once we got the camera and the microphones a very minor lighting set. Mm-hmm. It really has not cost us much to make these movies. I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars.
That's amazing.
We have no investors, I think. Nobody outside of us who's funding it. That's the main reason we call it zero budget.
But you also, but you did at certain points in your journey, did do some crowdfunding to kind of build, to try to get some bigger names in your niche, which is horror films. Is that correct?
That's true. As we got a few movies under our belt and decided we wanted to try to find, you know, some talent who would come on board for one of our smaller roles, like a day of filming. Mm-hmm. We did do a crowdfunding for those specific purposes. We had Bill Johnson. As a matter of fact, you said you were looking at moving to Austin, and Bill Johnson lives in Austin. He was Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw 2. He was in a couple of our movies, really fun to work with. But yeah, that was a great investment, I think, and it got people, you know, excited enough to help to make that happen.
Yeah, and that's something really important to this conversation, because when I first heard about what you guys were doing, you were following the Filmtrepreneur method before I even wrote the book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, because you are doing exactly what I've been preaching for a long time, which is find a niche audience that you can serve, which is you've decided to go after the horror audience. And then sometimes you go after big stars in that niche. They're not movie stars per se. They don't sell you overseas in Germany, but they do have a tremendous amount of value in the niche. Is that a fair statement? Someone like Bill Johnson actually does move copies because he is well known within the niche audience that you're trying to target. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and part of how we got connected with him was going to horror conventions. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, just networking that way is just so valuable when you're trying to build your audience and build you know, value added components to your filmmaking.
So I did the horror circuit early on with my first short film, which was more of like a creepy thriller, but the horror community really kind of attached themselves to it. It was like an action thriller. But I started selling it at horror conventions. So I've been through a bunch of horror conventions. And they're so much fun. I mean, so much fun. And you see all these amazing, actors from big horror movies, you know, obviously the Robert Englunds and Sid Haig. I met Sid Haig before he passed, and all these guys. But they're so accessible there, where you could literally walk up to these actors and go, "Hey, look, who do I talk to if I want to hire you to be in my next movie?" And you'd be surprised at how open they are. Some are a little bit more skittish, but others will just like, "Here's my email. Send me the script." They don't have a lot of value outside of the niche. I mean, obviously, when I say value, I'm talking about marketability and bottom line numbers. They're valuable in their acting and what they do as artists. But inside the horror niche, someone like Bill Johnson does move DVDs or moves rentals or so on. But did you find that as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We loved horror conventions. You know,
it's so much fun.
The thing we miss the most. Yeah, so much fun. We get to meet lots of different people and be in the same room with. We have a photo with some Walking Dead folks holding one of our creepy dolls that we took to the conventions with us, and mm-hmm. just really it's really easy to connect at those venues, and our big fans too. I mean, we really learned a lot from them, gained lots of fans, gained connections. The person who organized some of the conventions in Kentucky, we did a lot with him when he was beginning to put these conventions together. And that was a really good resource for us because we were friends with him before we were looking for someone to be in one of our movies. And he was the person who connected us with Bill Johnson. And we brought Bill in, and he was coming to the convention that year. We filmed while he was at the convention. So it made it a real easy, sort of a segue.
Right, you didn't have to pay for travel.
So smart.
Now you guys have a really unique distribution model. Can you talk about the origins of that distribution model? Because I'm assuming when you started doing your very first films, Warner Brothers wasn't releasing these things. So how did you start making money at the very beginning in the early 2000s, when you started 2007, 2008? I remember that time very well. DVD was still a thing back then. But how did you start making money with your films and do it in a way that you said, hey, wait a minute, I think we could do this again and again and again and again?
You want to take that one, Steve?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we first started doing it, DVD was really our only source of income. Streaming was talked about. It was, right. It was, hey, the future is streaming, but there really wasn't streaming yet. Streaming was, you know, YouTube and there just, it just wasn't out there too much yet. Mm-hmm. So it was really DVDs for our first few movies. That's it. We weren't making any money. We were just making movies because they were so inexpensive to make. You know, we're not having to invest a lot. We had already purchased all of the major equipment that cost the most. So the movies really were more about time. They were more time than they were money. I mean, seriously, we were not spending much to make these movies. It does show in the production values, but hell, you know, at least we were making them. So, mm-hmm. you know, so that was the thing. We didn't need a lot of money. We didn't need to make a lot of money to make our money back, which was minuscule. So it was DVDs for a long time until Amazon Prime came along and I hooked up with Indie Rights, mm-hmm. and Linda and Michael, and our movies started getting onto Amazon Prime. That's when we started to see a little bit of money. It's never been a ton. I mean, we're not making a lot of, we've never made a ton of money off of our movies, but mm-hmm. It's something, and something is better than nothing. And that was really the game changer, was once Amazon Prime came along and we hooked up with Indie Rights, then we started actually seeing a little bit of money from it too, which was nice.
One of the things that we did, though, that the first few years was that we always held like a local premiere and for the people who were in the movies and their friends and family and, you know, crew. And we always were able to make our initial investment back. Anything that we had that we spent to make those DVDs, we were able to get that back just from those premieres where we charged a little bit of money, sold some merchandise, had a, you know, really low cost venue to show the movie. So I think, you know, I think that kind of gave us the energy to keep going, for one thing. It kind of attracted, you know, some attention locally, and people wanted to be in the movie and be part of it, in the movies. And so doing another one was always something we looked forward to.
Now, has the recent Amazon purge affected you guys? Because I know they're now taking a lot of horror films are being just purged without reason. I know short films and documentaries, and they're just kind of purging their systems. Has that affected you? Because I know Linda told me that there was a handful of titles that she represented that were just purged.
Yes.
we lost one. We have 10 our movies were on Amazon Prime, and we lost one. They pulled one. The other nine are still there, but they're not making as much money. So there's been a drop in that, but we've only lost one thus far.
And also the rates. I mean, when you guys first jumped in with Linda, I mean, they were paying you guys could make some decent cash from just the SVOD aspect of it. But Amazon has been so ridiculously horrible to its independent creators now, paying them a penny for an hour if you're lucky.
Yeah, it makes me angry every time I think about it. It's like, no, wait a minute. We made this agreement, and then you're just gonna like, oh no, we're not gonna pay you that much. Now we're gonna pay you less. It's like, okay. So yeah.
it's really horrible. And they, but that's Amazon. They've been doing that for forever. And I think it happens with all the major platforms. Any major platform will accept anything to get the content that they need to build the platform up. But once they get to a certain level, they'll just start getting rid of the stuff that that they don't want to deal with anymore, or change the rules because it's their sandbox. And it's unfortunate. And it's happened with all of Tubi. Used to accept anything just to get it, to get content. And now they're being much more specific. Netflix. Do you remember Netflix streaming when it first launched?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. It was horrendous. I remember I logged in like in 2010 when it first showed up, just for out of curiosity. I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. This is just, and now of course they're the juggernauts and they won't accept anything anymore. Right. It's very, very difficult. So, I mean, so how have you guys kind of adjusted? Have you guys pivoted at all? Have you guys changed your model a little bit? Because, you know, from 2007 to now, there's a lot of things have changed. There was times when DVD, you could make a lot of money selling DVDs, and you probably still could, especially in the horror genre, on the festival circuit, in the horror circuit and things like that. But nowadays, just everything's changing so rapidly. Let's not even talk about COVID. And I'm sure how that's impacted your world as well. Are you guys pivoting? Is there anything that you are doing to kind of adjust? Because I'm assuming you're losing in some places like everybody else is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, how much can you really expect a movie that you put out 10 years ago to still be making money? You know, I mean, that's part of it. I think you have to keep up the marketing. And when we were putting out a movie every year, then our, you know, our old titles would get some interest. We did the 10 movies in 9 years and then took a break. Mm-hmm. And so we had already kind of pivoted a little bit. We decided we wanted to write this book, which mm-hmm. we did. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, COVID hit. So Steve and I both really are originally writers. And at least with COVID, you know, we've been able to focus on the writing and not feel like we're just letting everything go completely. But I, you know, we're kind of focusing on separate projects right now, just trying to get more, you know, more interest in the book and trying to find other ways to market the movies. But yeah, I'm not sure there's a good solution for that, those changes.
I was just going to kind of echo that a little bit. We were working at a crazy pace. I mean, releasing 10 movies in 9 years. So we decided to take just a little bit of a breather. And after we had a little bit of a breather, we decided we wanted to, we realized there's a lot of people out there who would like to know how we did it. Cause we get that asked that all the time. You know, I don't know how you do it. I mean, folks who have worked on million-dollar budget movies before would say to me, I don't know how you do this with no budget. So we decided to write a book about it and really go into detail. And it took it took longer than we thought it would when we were making the movies, we never really thought about all the details as much. We just kind of did it. Mm-hmm. And then when we were laying out everything that we did in the book, it was exhausting. It's like, my God, how did we do this? And it was just, I mean, it took a while to write it, but yeah, that's the book that we wrote, and it's out there. That's on Amazon too. That's Cheapskate Movie Makers. And it's been getting a really nice response so far. It actually, for a few days there, it actually hit as a bestseller in one of the categories. So we've been having some good success with that. And like PJ said, The pivot that we've done, one of the pivots that I've done, is because we wrote these movies, I've been turning the movies that we did into novel form. Mm-hmm. And I'm going ahead and been releasing them in as novels as well. So people that have been fans of the movie, you know, it's just another little twist that because we have writing, we are the writers, just another avenue to take. So, you know, we kind of do everything we can.
Yeah, and that is the core of the filmtrepreneur method, which is to create as many revenue streams outside of just the films themselves and control those revenue streams as much as possible. It was with as little middlemen as possible. So I was going to ask you about the books because that's unique. I hadn't seen, you know, book versions of or novel versions of independent, no budget films. That's a unique thing. And I'm assuming that still, you know, generates a little bit of money here and there. But the thing that a lot of filmmakers don't understand is like, oh, well, I only made a couple hundred bucks there off of that revenue stream a month. I'm like, yeah, but if you got 20 of those, all of a sudden that's becoming a really substantial thing. And as you build more and more of those revenue streams up, all of a sudden it becomes a business and all it becomes like, oh, wow, I'm making $1,000 a month. I'm making $2,000 a month. And depending on where you live in the country or in the world, that could be life changing. I mean, in LA, that gets you a trip to Whole Foods. But everywhere else, it could be a very substantial amount of money in your life. And that's another thing I always talk about. It's like, it's not about being rich and, you know, living that Hollywood, you know, myth, as you will. It's about how much money do you need every month to pay the bills, to support your family, to support your filmmaking habit. And it's a habit, it's a drug. It's absolutely a drug. It's an illness. It's a drug. I've said that many times. But if you can do that, then if you get to do your art and be happy about it and not have to worry about money when it regards to making your art, I think you've kind of won. Is that fair?
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I'll throw out here, one of the things we talk about a lot in the book is that your costs in a place outside of LA are so much lower. Your costs for filming, you know, getting people on board to help to work with you as a volunteer, because they don't have any other way to do that in, you know, in the Midwest or wherever you are. And so they're looking to, you know, to pursue their art as well. And so it's a win. I feel like we were doing it before lots of other people were doing it, because nobody just knew that you could, that it was a thing you could do. And we've gotten a lot of fans and people who are, you know, waiting for the next movie because they were part of it. I don't know if we could have done that. And I know we could have done that in LA, but we certainly could do it here, you know.
Now, how do you guys target and connect with your audience?
Well, one of the things we do really well, I think, is that we give our cast and crew and anybody who auditions or has any interest lots of value for their investment of time and money. Mm-hmm. We treat them well. We reach out to them with our, you know, with Facebook and anything else that we're doing, Twitter, let them know when we're having premieres. Making sure that the people who work with you are happy and feel valued, I think, grows your audience. Steve started putting audition notices out through several pages, websites in Kentucky. And in very beginning, we didn't have very many people who wanted to be involved. But gosh, what movie did we start really having? I think it was The Creepy Doll that we had so many people audition. And you know, if you think about that kind of energy as being a potential fan base, you can turn that around and keep those people interested all the way through. But we've done a lot of marketing on Facebook and Twitter, and just posting things, posting links, doing fun commercial kinds of things. We've posted a couple of our movies for free on YouTube. With promotions in them.
Yeah, and we really hit the ground too. I mean, the horror conventions was really quite a big deal for us to reach a wider audience. We just kind of pounding the pavement, going out there and kind of peddling our movies at conventions and slowly, gradually growing more and more of a fan base off of that. We have a website and a mailing list, so every convention, we get people to sign up for our mailing list, and then they get more, you know, they learn more about what's going on consistently without having to wait around for the next horror convention to find out. So It's just been kind of a grassroots type of a thing, and very, very gradual, but, you know, slow and steady.
We've been in a couple of magazines. We've won a couple of awards.
You find when you keep plugging away, little things like that'll happen. Like, we got a Maxim magazine listed our zombie movie Hell Is Full as one of the best 66 horror films you've never seen. I think that's awesome. That was the title. and that really brought a lot of people to us. Those little things like that, little unexpected things like that pop up, and all of a sudden your audience grows a little bit more. So, it just kind of comes from plugging away, and eventually little things like that happen.
And how
Ivana Cadaver's show, she's played our movies there and gotten some attention there.
And what's
that network? Yeah, Macabre Theater. Macabre Theater. Yeah.
You know, how important is your email list? Because I preach about that constantly. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, it's a big deal. That's where your fans are. That's how you keep them. You keep them engaged. You keep them up to date. I think it's essential. I mean, if you don't have an email list, you're really grasping at straws. That's really it's so important in anything you do. I mean, movies, books, whatever. It's really anything. Any industry where you're trying to grow any kind of a base. You need that email list. It really is a big deal.
And like we were talking earlier, when you're playing in someone else's sandbox, like let's say Facebook or Twitter or any social media platform, if they want to change the rules at the last second and not let you connect to your fans like Facebook did all those years ago, you have to now pay to access those fans who have liked you or followed you. You're screwed. But the email list is, you own that relationship with the email. And I've said this, and I've heard this said by a lot of other people in the online marketing space. The money is in the email list. I mean, because when you have a new product, you send it out to fans and people who want to hear from you, and you'll start getting sales right away. It's pretty powerful. I've seen it firsthand. It's a very powerful, powerful marketing tool. Now, other than you have your film. Revenues that come in through either indie rights or DVD sales or things like that. You have books. I know you have some merchandise as well. In order, kind of, what generates the most revenue for you guys from your catalog?
Oh, which
at the moment it's the book.
The books. Oh, okay. So the books are actually the higher revenue stream. So out of all the revenue streams, it's like books, then movies, then merch, or something along those lines? Or am I missing another revenue stream?
Yeah. No, that's it. That's, unless I'm forgetting something, PJ, I think that's the correct order. And then, of course, some of our movies do better than others.
Right. But as a general, like, monthly income that you're getting from your catalog of products and or ancillary products from your films, books happens to be what's making you the money right now.
Yeah, books are number one at the moment. Yeah,
right. If you looked at them over time, you know, I think movies have done better. The year that they come out, and then the year after that, a lot of times they'll generate a good big wave, mm-hmm. and then that kind of falls off after some time.
Go ahead. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say books tend to keep going and going and going, while movies, they have spikes and then they kind of drizzle out. But books are consistent because a horror story is a horror story, and you can read it, and there's no production value needed. There's no stars needed for a book.
Right. It's still so much fun, though, to get an email from or a message from somebody who says, "Oh, I just caught the creepy doll. This is a creepy doll that came out in 2011, you know?
Yeah.
I just caught the creepy doll and I love it so much." And I'm just like, I'm just So I feel so good when that, you know, when that still can happen.
I get those emails all the time. People talk about my film in 2005 I made. And people are like, oh, I just saw it, man. Or I bought that DVD years ago. And it, oh, my God, like it's such a thrill to get that. And I want people to understand.
It's really neat. And just to add on to what you were saying, movies, and I always would tell this to our cast, movies are forever. They don't leave. So your performance will be seen forever. In another 50 years, these movies will still be out there. They live on and on. They'll live on after we're gone. These movies are forever. It's pretty cool if you think about it. And one of the other really neat aspects of this that I never really thought of, it just kind of happened, is we are actually capturing history in our movies. There have been several buildings, old historic buildings that mm-hmm. we've shot in, that no longer exist today. They've been torn down, but mm-hmm. those live on forever in our movies. We've had some of our wonderful actors who have passed away since the movies have been released. Their performances live on forever in those movies. It's pretty neat. We're kind of like a time machine in a way.
No, it's absolutely. I've had actors pass away from projects I've done, and I've shot in locations that either have been remodeled completely or torn down completely. You're absolutely right. They're snapshots of time. It's really, really interesting. But I want the audience to really understand that as a business, what you guys have done is if you would have been just focused strictly on selling your movies only, and that would be the only way you make monies with your movies, it would be hard right now. But because you kind of branched out into books as another major revenue stream, that has now you can continue to generate revenue where the movies might be slowed down. So, and it's always it always kind of comes and goes, because sometimes, you know, like you said, a movie will come out and then boom, it'll be a big burst, and then books might drop a little bit and vice versa. But the more of these streams you have, the more chances you have to generate revenue.
Yeah.
Right. And another interesting thing about the books is the book world is a different world. Mm-hmm. It is a completely different world than the movie world. So a lot of the people who are reading the movie version of our books have never seen the movie. So boom, but everybody watches movies. Almost everybody in the world watches movies. So, you know, you get new fans that way. It's we're kind of dipping into a whole new world, which is interesting. And I really wasn't expecting the world to be so different, but they really are. The book world and the movie world are really two different worlds.
And your new book, Cheapskate Movie Makers, you know, you're using that filmtrepreneur model there as well, because I imagine that you talk about your movies in that book. And I promise you, probably somebody will go onto your website and want to watch your movies after they read your book as well. Have you found that happening yet?
Yeah. Also, we did set up a Patreon when we started writing the book, and that was another revenue for us as we were working on that project. People who had been part of our movies wanted to see how more about how we made them and get those chapters in advance. That was one of the things we did. But yeah, we've everybody who finds one piece of us is more likely to reach out and, you know, see another one of our movies or read another one of our books or find out more about us.
Right. They're each
in that book we really did. We used a lot of examples in the books of movies. Like in this movie, we use this aspect, and this is a special effect we used in this movie. So we did that a lot. So anybody who reads the book, if they want to see the specifics, they actually have to watch the movie. So it is actually we did kind of use that as a hook to get get them to watch the movies as well. But you know, it wasn't gimmicky. I mean, it's like if you really do want to see what we're talking about, you really should watch this. And yeah, so, you know, it's a yin and yang kind of a thing.
Oh, in my book, in the Rise of the Film Entrepreneur, I literally, in the book, I'm saying, hey guys, I'm using the Film Entrepreneur method on you right now. Here, watch. Go to www.egoanddesire.com and you can check out my film that I'm talking about and breaking down in this chapter. You see?
And I
actually said, don't hate the player, hate the game. And we just moved on from there. But because I wanted to be very transparent about, I'm like, look, I'm doing it right now to you. So everything I'm preaching to you in the book, I'm actually doing to you as you're reading this book. And not in a bad way. It's a valuable way, because if you're reading a book about cheapskate movie makers, you want to watch their cheapskate movies. You know, you want to see how they did it and what they're doing and what their website looks like and how they're generating revenue and so on. But I'm so glad. And I imagine you're going to do very well with Cheapskate Movie Makers as a book, because yeah, I'm assuming it's self-published like mine's are. And, you know, it's insane. It's insane kind of the shelf life that books have. Much more,
right.
much more. And there's discovery in people. There's so many more people willing to spend 10 or 15 bucks on a book than it is to rent a movie. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing.
And there's so many people out there who are hungry for this level of filmmaking, I think. Not tell me how to make a movie with $100 million. Tell me I can walk out of my door and make a movie.
Yeah, I always said to people, I'm like, you know, when I was making my DVD in 2005 on how to make an independent film, you know, there was nothing on the market like that. Sure, there was Robert Rodriguez talking about how to make a $7 million film. And that's great, Robert, but I don't have a Steadicam. So I need something with everyday tools. And I think you're right. There is a hunger for filmmakers that don't have that kind of, which is basically everybody except for a handful of people that don't have those kind of those budgets and those resources to access this kind of information. And I applaud you guys for putting the book together as well. It's very, very cool. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Just do it. Just make your movie. Don't. There's a million reasons why not to do it. Forget that. Just do it. If you really want to do it, go out there, make yourself a movie however you can. Once the movie's over, you'll know whether or not this is for you or not.
Yep. Just try things and then try to get better. All the tools are there. All the tools, all the tips, all the advice, it's out there. But you just got to have a little, you know, moxie and just do it.
Moxie. I haven't heard that in a while. That's nice. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh my goodness. That's hard. I want to say that haters are going to hate.
Preach, sister.
And so, you know, if you find that if you get really bent out of shape because somebody's hating on what you're doing, it probably means you're doing something right. Mm-hmm. And that you should, you know, you should take a look and make sure you're not hurting anybody or anything. But I think that if you've risen to the level where somebody's criticizing you, that means you're rising. So, you know, just keep doing that.
Yeah, that's a really good one, because I think early on, you know, you've made a movie, you've accomplished something, I'm the king of the world, and then you see a review and it's like, this movie sucks, these people are awful. Mm-hmm. You know, at first that can be a little bit of a downer, but you know, you kind of have to. There's a couple aspects to that. Number one is they're not wrong. We're talking about art, so when somebody watches or looks at art, they're going to have an opinion, and it's not wrong. That's their opinion. If they didn't like the movie, they didn't like the movie. But I think it's wiser to focus on the people who did. Because that's your audience. Your audience are the people who get what you're doing, who enjoy what you're doing. That's your audience. You should focus on your audience. The people who, you know, it doesn't resonate with, that's not your audience. You really don't need to worry about that too much.
Isn't it amazing that when you get a bad review, you could have 100 5-star reviews and you get one-star review, and that's the only one you focus on. Isn't it amazing?
Oh God. It just feels so slapped.
But you've got 99 other great, amazing reviews, but you're like, yeah, but that one dude. it's so brutal. My advice to anyone out there listening who gets bad reviews, which is basically everybody, including every major director or artist is I always, for filmmakers, I always like to just go, just do a search for bad review Godfather, bad review Shawshank Redemption, and then just start laughing. Because there's bad reviews written about some of the greatest films of all time, and it makes you feel a little bit better. I always makes me feel better.
It's true. Pick anything in the history of the world that is art related. There's somebody who hates it. And again, it's not that they're wrong. They truly, really hate it. It's not like it's not like deep down they're like, oh, I love this, but I'm not going to admit it. No, they really hate it. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. Not everything. Everything's not for everyone.
Yeah, I try to say, you know, I can respect this maybe for what this does. It's just not up my alley, rather than this is terrible.
Oh, no. When they get personal, it's the best. I mean, when I first started, I used to go, I was like literally going after every bad reviewer. And I would just literally just start attacking back when I was first starting out, when I was younger. All those years ago. And it's such a ridiculous thing because it's just an opinion. It is absolutely just an opinion from somebody. And like you're saying, Steve, they're right. You know, people look at Van Gogh and just go, ugh, with the blues and the starry, whatever. Oh God. So cliche. Like there's always somebody and there's always someone who's gonna, you know, I think it was Roosevelt who said, the man who critiques the man who stumbles in the arena has no place to say anything because they don't have the courage to get into the arena or something along those lines. You know, it's what it is. I mean, if you have an opinion, you have an opinion, but it is brutal. And I know a lot of directors, big directors, don't even read reviews. I know Ridley Scott never reads a review, ever, 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 ever reads a review. He's like, no, I don't bother. Good or bad. Good or bad. And now, guys, three of your favorite films of all time.
Jaws, number one.
Awesome.
Number two, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, Scarface.
Nice.
And I'm going to give you a bonus, something a little different, Deer Hunter.
Nice. All great, solid choices, sir. Very good. How about you, PJ?
Well, thank you.
Well, you're not gonna understand why I wrote horror, because horror is not really the genre that I love the most.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I do love it, but gosh, that's so hard. I'm gonna say Carrie. It's one of my favorites.
I love De Palma. Great.
I'm sure I'm going to sit here after we're gone. I wish I had listened and known I was going to need to come up with these, but I'll probably think of like 10 more afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I really love The Piano.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so great. Yeah, yeah. Jean Campion. It was wonderful.
I'm a big fan of female directors. A more recent one that I really loved was Under the Skin.
Oh, yeah. That's the one from, is that the one with Scarlett?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. If
it's a trip, it's a trip.
Oh, yeah.
It is a trip. That film. Yes. But guys, thank you so much for being on the show. You are an inspiration to so many filmmakers out there, and hopefully they'll read your book, Cheapskate Movie Makers: How We Made 10 Horror Movies in 9 Years with Nearly Zero Budget. And hopefully you continue to inspire many filmtrepreneurs and filmmakers moving forward. So thank you so much for being on the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I want to thank PJ and Steve for coming on the show and inspiring the Filmtrepreneur tribe today. Thank you so, so much, guys. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/070. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com and subscribe and leave a good review for the show.
It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.